You're listening to Amphibicast.
This week's episode of Amphibicast is sponsored by ExoTerra. For quality products tailored to your amphibian's needs, including everything from terrariums to vivarium supplies and decor, substrate, misting systems, lighting supplies, and much more, visit exo-terra.com or visit your local dealer. A special shout-out this week goes to our newest sponsor, the Frog Breeder Merch Store. Show off your love for frogs and conservation by picking up some unique frog merchandise with portions of the proceeds going to Panamanian Amphibian Conservation. With everything from adults to kids to stickers to t-shirts, the Frog Breeder Merch Store has everything for the frog lover out there. To find out more and to purchase some merch, check out the-frog-breeder-merch.myspreadshop.com and follow the link in the show description. Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining me again. Hope you guys enjoyed last week's episode. I really did. And, trying to branch out and do some more diverse topics, which is something that you guys had asked for. And, had a lot of fun. So this week is going to be no exception. I've got a terrific guest this week. I have Sharif, Bunch of Tanks, on Instagram. You may know Sharif from the famous viral photo of the Atalopus. We're going to talk about that, but more importantly, we're going to talk about some of Sharif's builds and just frog care, approaches to keeping, stuff like that. So I'm really excited. I love having people on the show who do a great job with builds, and Sharif's builds are incredible. We're going to get into all that. We've got a whole big list of topics we're going to cover. So I'm looking forward to this week. And of course, if you want to support the show, you want to get merch, you want to get all that stuff, check out the sponsors, check out the links in the show description. It'll take you to the sponsors for this week. It'll take you to the link tree, which will take you to the Patreon page. $5 tier, get your shout out at the beginning of an upcoming episode. Great way to support the show. And if you're looking to support the show in another way, leave a nice review. 5-star ratings that go a long way. Helps the podcast get out there to a larger audience, which is something that I've kind of been my goal from day one. And if you want to support the show, simple review on your favorite podcast player is the way to do it. So, Sharif, welcome. It is so great to finally get to talk to you. I've mentioned you on this show so many times. Your builds are incredible. The Atalopus, the Orange Blackfoot, so much I want to talk to you about. But how you doing tonight? Thank you for coming on. What's going on this evening?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me on. I feel like I've heard my name a few times that I had to finally do an episode.
Yeah, and I apologize. I should have had you on much earlier, and I'm glad that we finally got a chance to catch up. So let's get into it. I want to hear about you. I mean, your name is a Bunch of Tanks on Instagram, but like, what was the first tank? What was the very first foray that you got into with regards to frogs or the natural world or animals or keeping? What was the inception for everything that got you on this path?
The very first tank was a 5-gallon from PetSmart with goldfish from the fair. With two more that I picked up from PetSmart. She said I can have three, but now I know not to trust them anymore. 3 goldfish in a 5-gallon is a bit too much. But that's how it started, with that 5-gallon. And then shortly after that, I went the planted tank route. And they didn't live that long, living in a 5-gallon. After that, it was a 10-gallon. And then after that, another 10-gallon, and then a few more 10-gallons, and then slowly upgraded from that, went to a 20-gallon, to a 40, to a couple 70, to a 55, to 75s. And then at one point, I had a bedroom just full of aquariums around me. And that's where a bunch of tanks really started, with the aquariums. And then shortly after that, I took a break, moved around a bit, settled in an apartment in New York, and got my first terrarium. Always wanted to be a fish tank, but ended up going the easier route because the AC and heat weren't really stable in that apartment. So it was just a little terrarium with nothing in it. And I think from there is where I started all my dart frog research and wanting the frogs. But I couldn't really have live food in an apartment with the flies crawling around. And so a few years after that, eventually moved. And then my partner and I, we finally got morning geckos. And then from there is where the dart frog line started. Started supplementing the morning geckos with fruit flies from PetSmart. And then finally realizing it wasn't too bad as what I thought it would be. And then from there, I got my first and they were the Epitomates, Antonia, Santa Isabel's. And then it's all downhill from there. But I've always felt drawn to the natural world and plants. I've always been curious about it all. I loved growing plants. Some of my favorite species have always been succulents and bromeliads ever since I was a kid.
So I just want to back up to, because the aquarium part of the, part of how you got started interests me as well. Did you just keep goldfish, or did you expand to keep tropical fish, or which fish species did you go along the way with?
So it started with goldfish, but then shortly after they died, I didn't go back to them, because after that, I kind of went down the rabbit hole of aquariums and actually getting my research right, figuring out the tank sizes and all, and going the whole live plant route. And then from there, I started with a betta just to start. And then after that, I finally got into tetras, the cichlids, the corys, and all of that. And I still love them to this day, and I'll still get some more. And right now, I don't have any, but I have pea puffers.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you're not the first person that's told me that. I've talked to a few people that have them. What's it like?
I just listened to an episode. I think it was 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. The guy had pea puffers.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, they're pretty cool. They're very inquisitive, intelligent, fun to watch and interact with. Do enjoy them, but you definitely have to feed live food with them. So it's nice. So I also have a snail tank to go with that pea puffer tank.
Cool. That must be pretty stunning. And... Mm-hmm. At some point, I mean, this was my progression was I was keeping everything that wasn't, I mean, I wasn't into fish, obviously, but everything that I was keeping at the time when I started out, kept in aquariums. And then over time, I started moving everything into exoterras because it just became much more user-friendly, especially for the frogs. Did you start out keeping frogs in aquariums, or did you go straight to like a more dart frog-centered type of enclosure?
No, I did. I started with the aquariums. And then eventually I kind of upgraded from that, but it did start with a 20 gallon.
What kind of gave you the idea to like the tanks weren't working for you? Cause like I put up with it for way too long.
Yeah. The reaching in from the top to do all the maintenance was the part that I hated the most. And then especially when you add the flies, they tend to just want to walk up everything. So the first thing they walk up is the front glass. And then they get calcium dust everywhere, and then the humidity on top of that, and then that cakes over real quick. It's just easier with front opening.
I have the same problem, and it's funny because you're right. They always go right up the front glass, and they don't do that with the exoterras for some weird reason. They only do it in the aquariums. And you're right. It just causes a nightmare of calcium buildup and hard water stains. It looks terrible.
So I've always just, started small, and then I kind of just upgraded as I've learned more and more.
What was your first dart frog tank? Like, what did it look like? Because, like, the tanks you have now are incredible. Like, was there a progression for you in terms of how you started out with design mm-hmm. and things like that? Like, can you maybe kind of walk us through the creative process from where you first started as opposed to where you are now?
So the first tank is a 20 gallon. I think I have it on my Instagram page, too. It's one of the first ones. And then from there, I did the traditional gray stuff and cork backgrounds. I only did that once and learned that I would never do it again. And then from there, I think I stuck with cork a lot, the natural cork. Did cork mosaics, cork and silicone, and then just kind of stuffed the sphagnum in the cracks. Really enjoy doing it that way. And then slowly from there, just more cork. To one point where I did the Zoomed cork backgrounds, but didn't like how flat they were. And then one day I just stumbled upon, it was Biotope Gallery, using the thick pressed cork. But what he did, what I don't see many people do, is just scrape it. And then that's where the idea came for the cork builds that I've recently been doing more and more of. And I gradually just shifted to all my builds being all cork backgrounds. Because before, it was a bit of a mix of everything. Like, I tried great stuff with the cork. I've done a dry lock build here and there. Hygrolon builds. And I think... yeah. And then the real cork. Cork mosaic builds.
Well, I want to get into the cork mosaic as a technique because, I mean, what you do is very impressive. It's an interesting medium, and I want to hear about how you work with it and, you know, why, in your opinion, it's a superior build for you. But I was wondering if you could tell us, maybe give us a rundown of the species that you are keeping right now, just so we kind of have an idea of what you're keeping in addition to, I mean, obviously we know you've got the Atalopus and the Orange Blackfoots, but can you give us a rundown of everything you have?
Yes. So it all started with the group of Epitibates, Antoniae, Santa Isabels. Started with a group of five of those. Eventually did what everybody does and bred those. Ended up with 22 of them. And then eventually, I held on to them for a year because nobody really wanted them. So at one point, I was able to sell them all for a cheaper price and ended up letting go of most of them, but keeping two of my favorites, two males. And then a week after I got the Isabels, I picked up the Leucomelas, a group of Leucomelas, then got into Tinks after that, finally got into Amazon, ran into Maya, picked up a couple of those, Amazonica and Variabilis, and then finally got the Blackfoots, and I think me and you got them on the same day, too. And shortly after that, Vanzolini, finally ventured into Pomelio. And then I got the Atalopus, another pair of Pomelio, and then a Red-Eyed Tree Frog.
You've got a You got a pretty big collection now. What's it like managing, like, all of that? Like, maybe kind of give us an idea of what an average day in the frog room is for you in terms of maintenance and, you know, like, do you have a misting system set up and what's your feeding routine? Kind of run us the details of how you manage to keep everything in your collection.
I used to have everything hooked up to a misking, and then I moved and I had to unhook it all up, and I haven't fully hooked it up all back together yet. So I wake up, I usually go down, wait till the lights come on, and I spray everything, but I only do that once every other day. I do have some tanks I spray daily. One of them is the Atalopus tank, and then my grow outs, and one of my tink tanks, just because I wanted the moss to become more established before I cut back to every other day.
But generally, I just go down,
check them out, make sure everybody's doing good, and feed all the froglets I have growing.
You know, something, an interesting detail that I was talking to someone about actually earlier today was like the placement of your frog or slash animal room in the house. And mine's in my basement, and I'm dying to get back upstairs into a room with natural sunlight. I mean, you have thoughts on that about like where frog room placement is in the house or in the home or in the apartment? Or like, how does placement play a role when you've got it like a big collection? Because like for me, it's kind of utilitarian. I kind of have to have everything in down there, but I'd love to have a room where I actually get some real sunlight. Like, where do you keep your stuff in the house? And like, do you have any thoughts about like the value of placement, or, you know, where, like, if in a perfect world, where would you love to have your frog room if you had to move it from where it is now?
I do love having them in the basement. Like, the temps are stable down there. I do get some sunlight into the Atalopus tank and my Luke tank. I do have a little window that comes through. But I do like how the basement holds temperature really well compared to the other rooms.
That's a good point. I had to, although I mean, with my mind gets really dry in the winter time, and in the summer I got to run the central AC.
Oh yeah.
Otherwise it just gets,
I had that problem too.
There. Yeah. It's not fun.
Yeah. When I was in New England, that was my same issue. It was dry in the winter, humid in the spring and the summer. So I always had to like switch up my misting system and schedule just to counter that, or tape off some of the vents or open it up some more. I do vent more than most people do. It's more around 25 to 30%, like a quarter ventilation in the front. And I find that works best for me. I only have to mist once every other day now with my humidity sitting around 50% in the room. But I think once it jumps up and it starts to warm up, I will switch to daily again.
And what about your tadpoles that you're growing out? Do you have a preferred method that you like to use for tadpole growth?
Yeah. So the ones that can be grown communally, I like to use an aquarium. A filtered aquarium with a bunch of leaves and sticks. I find they really do graze on the algae that grows on the sticks. And they do graze on the algae that grows, or the biofilms that grow on the Indian almond leaves. It's just fun to actually just be able to observe them instead of them being in cups. But then for Ranitomea, I do put them in cups because they'll eat each other.
And do you have a preferred tank size that you like to do? Because I've noticed a lot of your builds seem to be pretty large. You've got 36 by 36 and 18 by 36. Like, when you want to do a build, do you have a preferred size? And is there a reason why you pick a particular size?
That's a good question. Don't have one yet. It's more of what I can find on Facebook Marketplace. So it's kind of just started with 12 18s and kind of moved up from there. I've kind of shifted away from all of the 12 18s, and now most of them are 18 24s with a couple of 36 18 36s and then the 36 18 18s. But if I had to pick a size, I would say the size that's most fun to scape would be the 18 24s, the 24 36s, and then the largest size, 36 36. The more rectangular ones have been the fun ones to scape.
So let's walk through a build with the cork. Let's walk us through it from start to finish. I mean, let's begin with where you source it from. Like, do you have a preferred place that you get your panels from?
I do, but their price keeps going up. So I'm going to start looking for a new method. It just skyrocketed.
And what type of cork? This is like acoustic panels or something on par with that, right?
Yeah, I find them. They're easily found under cork insulation panels.
Gotcha. And they're kind of like that dark brown color, right?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, they're pretty popular with sound engineering for That's the first time I saw them, and it never even occurred to me to use those in this type of situation. But you know, here we are.
Yeah, it took a few times for me to see it to actually realize, oh, this would actually do good in a tank.
So when you get, let's just say, we'll do a hypothetical build here. Let's just say a 36 by 24. So say you want to do a background for a 36 by 24. You've got the cork. What happens next?
So what I usually like to, so there's three thicknesses that the cork sizes come in. There's the half inch thick, 1 inch thick, and the 2 inch thick. What I started doing, or what I've been doing, is wrapping the walls with a half an inch. And then from there, I'll plan out my hardscape, because I like having the cork on the walls because they hold the hardscape in place. You just kind of like jam it in and they stay without having to like tape it up or any of that. I could just stick it up on there. And then once my hardscape is set, then I can plan how I'll stack the thicker pieces of cork on top. So from there, I could either use the 1 inch or the 2 inch, depending on how much depth I want to do. So lately, I've just been buying the 2 inch. And then with the 2 inch, you could just split in half and then use it however, or you could just use the full 2 inch piece on top. And then from there, it's kind of like Legos, building ledges out of that half inch wall. And just kind of shifting and moving it around and having it complement the hardscape. So if I had a branch that I wanted to look more rooty or more like a root, I can easily add another line of cork that kind of looks like another branch coming out of the wall, but it's not really a piece of wood, it's just cork. Because eventually it all gets covered.
And how do you adhere the pieces to the background and to one another?
All silicone. And the good thing about it is most of the time I just use one tube.
So I'm looking at one of your pictures on your Instagram page. This is from like maybe, looks like July 2023. You've got some, looks like you've got ghost wood in there, right? Do you have a preferred wood type that you like to use?
All the aquarium woods. Like I try to mix it up and use different types of wood. I do come back to ghost wood a lot because it's the easiest to find as a like a what you see is what you get piece. But I have used Malaysian driftwood. I do enjoy using that. Ghostwood is a favorite. Cork. And then I have one build that the wood there is called kimchi. Not sure why, but it turned out great.
For hardscapes, do you draw inspiration from anything specific? Like, do you check out photos of nature? Do you, mirror what you see with other builders? Like, how do you, like, the artistic aspect of it? Like, what do you look for when it comes to designing a hardscape?
It's a bit intuitive. I just kind of feel it as I go. I do like to have it aquascaped in a certain way, because that's where I started. But I do try to combine the frog part of it and not the fish part of it. Because there's a little bit of a difference where in fish keeping, you don't really have a background to work with. Whereas with dart frog builds, you could incorporate a background and like build off of that. I try to follow the aquascaping rules, the rules of threes, odd numbers, triangles, the golden ratio and all that, just so they look aesthetically pleasing.
I've heard of the golden ratio, but for the listeners who aren't familiar, can you explain that?
The golden ratio. I'll explain it. It is picking a corner, drawing a grid in your tank. Two lines down the middle, two lines down the side across. And then the four points that intersect. I usually pick one as a starting point. And then from there, the starting point I pick will be the focal. And then from there, I'll just kind of draw my spiral and build off of that.
What about the Atalopus build? You did a paludarium, which was, you've used a couple of different, you used polyurethane foam, looks like you used some of the pink solid insulation. What went into planning of that? Because you designed this really, really elaborate water feature for this paludarium type of setup. How did you plan that and how did you execute it?
That build was overwhelming. I kind of just took it day by day and figuring out the next step as it went on. So it was kind of a build that was just continually worked on and figured out as I went on. So I didn't really know what I was doing when I was building it, but I knew that I wanted a solid structure there for them to walk on and the stream. Like I had that drawn out and pictured, but then I kind of just winged it one step after the other.
Once everything was up, did you have to go back and modify anything? Or because like with water features, it's sometimes it's complicated because once you have everything set in the foam, you can't always go back and modify it easily. Like, were there any hiccups or any issues that you had? Because, I mean, I know I had my share of them when I made water features.
Oh, yeah. It started to leak. The whole build started to leak. And it was right at the end, too, as I started foaming in the substrate in, the filter foam. As soon as I started gluing that in with the silicone and then foaming the edges and the cracks, is when it started to leak. So I had to pull everything out, strip all the silicone, re-silicone it, and then put everything back in. But that was a setback I didn't enjoy.
And that was a custom glass tank, or that was a tank that you already, that was already like prefabbed?
It was the Exoterra.
Yeah, leaks can be tough. So, Atalopus, you got those from where? From Nick Stacy, right?
I got it from a friend that got it from Nick Stacy.
Gotcha. Nick Stacy's like the godfather of Atalopus. Everybody needs to like chip in and get Nick a vacation to like Fiji or something like that, because he's done so much. And I think there's a new species of Atelopus he's got that he's working mm-hmm. with.
On Elegance?
Yeah.
Or Elegance?
You have your eye on them too?
The one I want is the one nobody can have. The golden Panamanian one.
Oh, is it techie? Yeah.
Yeah. That's the one I want.
Yeah, everyone wants a techie. So the techie is interesting because if I were to speculate, I don't think that the situation for Zatecki is that great in the wild. And I mean, again, if I were to speculate, odds, I mean, they could very well end up just existing in captivity from here on in. So who knows? Maybe there will be a point when we see Zatecki. I mean, it's a shame. It shouldn't be that way, but
yeah,
I wouldn't, nothing would surprise me at this point. I of all the species of Atelopus, I think that I know of anyway, I feel like Zatecki's kind of like losing the good fight.
Mm-hmm.
And plant wise, obviously you do like very, very fully planted tanks. Like what are some of your favorites and how is it getting plants to grow on the cork background? Like, is there any special techniques or anything that you use or anything that might differ from like other types of builds?
They're pretty. It's pretty much the same. I a little bit of sphagnum, I pin them on with stainless steel wire, and then from there they just kind of take a while to settle, and then they start taking off. It does take a while for the cork to actually hold moisture, so I usually do spend the first week or two kind of just dousing it down as it like fully molds over, and then I find after that is usually when I plant in, everything will do well. Because if you plant it right in the beginning, that's for any build though, right in the beginning, you get that mold phase that usually likes to choke out plants. I usually wait for that to subside and then I plant.
What's the longevity on the cork panels?
I don't know that. For what I could say, the longest I have is coming up on 3 years. And that would be my Luke tank. And so far, none of it is disintegrated. It's still there, intact. Holds moisture and it has moss grown over it.
Yeah, the cork's products seem to be pretty indestructible. And the only time I've ever had any deteriorate was when I kept it like fully submerged. And even then, it didn't really, yeah. It just kind of like a layer of it kind of like melted or whatever, like over the course of mm-hmm. like several months, and then what I had left is pretty much there for the long haul.
Yeah, I had that happen in one of my builds with the natural cork panel. The one that's kind of just like real natural cork and it's pressed on cork board and glued. I didn't cut out the part for the drainage. And that whole part, when I broke down that tank, just kind of just fell apart and melted.
Really?
Yeah, it just kind of like rotted away as I was pulling it out.
I wonder how it's processed. So was it the natural part or the pressed part that rotted?
It was the pressed part, I think.
Really? I wonder if they use some sort of adhesive or something like that to... Because, I mean, it seems like it's so much more processed than the other cork products.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, like, plus it doesn't... like stuff like that doesn't really seem like it was made for like super duper wet environments anyway. I mean, most of the times those are for like backs like gecko enclosures and whatnot, but yeah, it's interesting to see how one product can decay and the other one can just last forever.
And now I've combined it with Hygrolon. Well, not Hygrolon, Speaker Mesh.
Tell me about that. What's your experiences with that been? Because that's one of the few background media that I've never actually used. What was that like?
It's pretty much the same. I haven't really noticed any differences yet. Like, it grows moss, it holds moisture well, maybe even better than cork. But the way I did it is, like, I glued the speaker mesh on the glass and then the cork on top of that, just so it wasn't too... didn't look like a speaker mesh background. And the plants have been climbing it just fine, and there's moss growing on it now. And it's been doing really well. It's not Hygrolon, but it works.
Yeah, it's interesting how it looks like the speaker foam. Like I've seen that, like the what's the word I'm looking for? Almost like generic Hygrelong. Like that's the same like speaker foam. So like you really didn't notice much of a difference in name brand, right? It kind of just did the same thing.
Yeah. I just found one that was commonly used by hobbyists and used that.
So did it wick water from the bottom of the tank all the way up to the top of the tank, or did you have to mist it to get the whole cloth or whatever you want to call it saturated?
No, I intentionally have it touching or into the drainage layer so that it wicks.
So it'll wick water up like a foot, 2 foot off the out of the drainage layer?
It seems to only go halfway up. The top layer doesn't really get wet. It dries out quick too. But everything below like the first third is staying moist.
So with the Atelopus, this is one of those things that I watched this phenomenon happen and it was so funny. So this is the infamous photo of the Atelopus, the buns photo, we'll call it.
The buns.
The cheeks. So, I mean, one of the things about amphibians that makes them really endearing is their kind of, you know, semi-human characteristics, like the, you know, the rain frogs and, I wouldn't compare rain frogs with Atelopus, but they both, you know, apparently they've got cheeks. So, that made them really, really popular, I guess, on TikTok and whatever other platforms are out there. So you posted a photo, which I made a stupid comment on. Apparently, people thought that was really funny. How did that photo becoming viral? And you've got shorts that went viral too. You had like a million views on a couple of your reels, right?
What was the Terribilis reel?
What was that like going from having just a channel that showcased your frogs and your builds to being in front of a million people and having all these people who were, I guess, not frog people or frog people, whatever combination, reacting to this content? Like, what was that like?
Are they poisonous? That's the number one question I would get. But I mean, it's at one point, like, you think it's cool. You get all that and like the attention and all the shares and all the likes and your follower count blows up. But I mean, I hope it did good for the frogs.
Yeah, it was funny. I was just trying to like picture people's reactions because it was just such a funny photo, the one with the Atelopus and just looking all sorry.
Oh, yeah, that photo. It's the butt cheeks. It's standing up and like it just reminded people of. I got comments saying Hank Hill looking people. And then people related to it, and like it kind of does look like a little old man standing up with a little belly.
Yeah, it's a great photo, and it's. I mean, again, I'm not into anthropomorphizing animals, but like, just sometimes they do these things that are just we interpret as being just so remarkably human that it just makes them so relatable. Like a snake is not going to pose like that. An axolotl is not going to pose like that,
and they do that a lot too.
Really?
Yeah, that's how they they'll stretch out right before they get a fruit fly, so they'll fully extend before they shoot their tongue out. Usually, so not all the time.
What other behaviors have you noticed? I mean, have you seen? Do you have a pair, or do you just have an unsexed group?
I have four males.
Okay, so there's no females in there at all.
No, not yet. Maybe one day.
Like, what kind of behaviors have you seen them engage in?
They fight over territory. They fight over everybody wants the bromeliad to be in it. And it usually just goes to one or two of them. So they'll fight over that. And like, they tend to call at each other, wrestle. They do have a few different calls, a submission call, just one where they like, an aggressive call. They had their mating call, from what I've noticed so far. They are fun to watch walk. They do this slow walk. They usually have these spots that they visit, they frequent. Their favorite spots usually change every now and then, but they are almost always out in the open at night. Like, they'll walk to their bedtime spot, and it's usually always out in the open for you to see. And that usually happens almost an hour or two right before lights go off, almost every day. You can see them walk to their bedtime spot. And then when they wake up, it's usually when they wake up, and then they'll walk to their favorite spot. And then usually when they're hungry, you can tell because they'll start walking around searching for food. And it's unlike dart frogs. Like, you won't see a dart frog go to sleep out in the open. They usually go retreat somewhere. So it's kind of like they're the opposite of dart frogs. Dart frogs come out during the day. They kind of go in during the day. They'll come out at night. Dart frogs go in at night.
Are they active all night? Like, if you went in there like sundown up to sun up, you see them out all night?
I don't know about the night times. I haven't really sat there and watched to see what they do at night. But I've heard them call a few times at night with lights off.
Have you ever seen them do the little hand motions that they do?
No, I wish. I don't think they do it. When they do it, I just think they're just like wiping their eye. I don't think it's actual sign language.
I wonder if it has something to do with... the theories that I've heard is that they do the behavior because when they're in a stream environment, there's so much noise from the moving water that calling would be ineffective. So it's interesting. I mean, I've never kept them, so I really don't know, but I'm interested in the fact that they actually have several different calls. And it'd be interesting to see what would happen if you got a female in there, if that repertoire would increase. Because we always think about them from the scientific perspective, as being really, to my knowledge, was silent. I didn't realize they had that many calls that they exhibited.
Oh, yeah. They're pretty vocal sometimes, especially during when it starts to rain or during a storm.
So when the whole photo went viral and everything, did you get people asking, like, oh, how can I get one? How should I keep one? Like, what did that?
Yeah. Yeah. And then I just kind of just sent everybody Nick's way. I had to go back and edit the photo and edit the caption. Like, they're endangered. Don't get them wild caught, please. Go to Nick. Get captive bred ones.
How many people do you think were serious about it versus people who were just like, oh, I want one. They're so cute.
I don't know. I didn't really see much of an after effect. Usually with the terribilis, I saw lots of people getting terribilis after that. And especially from me. But with the Atelopus, I haven't really noticed much people getting Atelopus after that.
Maybe it was a price tag. They're kind of up there.
Yeah, could be. I've noticed more people getting them now.
I think people might be a little bit less intimidated by them because they've been around for a few years now. What was the first? I think Nick came out. What was the first one? Was it Balios?
Mm-hmm. I think Balios was the first one.
And I remember when he released those. And I'm like, be cool if he released the purple ones. And then like a year later, after everyone had the Balios out, they came. Yeah, it's cool. It's cool though. I feel like they might have been a little bit intimidating to people just because of the high price point and just that reputation of being really fragile, which now that they've been in captivity and so many people you're having great luck with them. Obviously Nick is like the OG with them, but Nat up in Canada, Nat Attack, she has hers breeding, and there's a couple other people I know who are working with them and just having really, really good success. I mean, it still seems to be pretty complicated to raise up the tadpoles because they're so small, but it's encouraging to see people have a positive experience with an animal that 10, 15 years ago was a total crapshoot. I mean, they were all wild caught. I remember Stefania Facci, the dart frog queen, she had Atelopus sateki like 10 years ago or something like that. I interviewed, she's not in the hobby anymore. I interviewed her maybe 2 years ago, but she had, not sateki. I'm sorry. Scratch that.
I was like, how'd she get them?
No, yeah, I'm forget that. I, No, she had one of the species that's in the trade today. I don't remember which one, but she had a lot of success with them, and they were wild caught imports, which at the time was really all that was available because nobody was working with them, and the status of all the different species in the wild was unknown in certain situations. But she was able to handle them, like handle their care perfectly. But at the same time, it was also this, you're going to spend hundreds of dollars on a wild caught toad. You want to make sure that the thing does well in captivity. And it was, back before they became readily available, courtesy of Nick, it was really sketchy trying to deal with any kind of wild frogs, and especially Atelopus.
Yeah, their care for me hasn't been any different than dart frogs. They're pretty much, I treat them pretty much the same way. They do have more ventilation because it's a paludarium. But other than that, it's pretty much the same.
So if you were to give someone advice about how to set up, let's say a small group of Atelopus like you have, what would you recommend to the person in terms of what to set up, sizes, temperatures, feeding? Maybe just give us like a rundown of the care.
Ooh, I kind of copied what the last guy had. He had his in a similar setup. It was a 36-36 paludarium. But if I were to do it again, I would say go with a pair. And maybe try to make it similar to a dart frog build. Because their care is really not that different. It was very much the same when it comes to their care. Although they do seem to go longer without eating, they can eat a lot less from what it seems.
What about seasonal variability? Like, do you ever do like a drier season versus a wetter season?
I haven't yet, but I set it up in where I can. I can easily just unhook the canister and drain all the water out if I wanted to run a dry season. Which I might be doing, maybe, depending in the summer, how the weather goes. Because it's my first time here in this house, so I'm not sure how the summers will be here and how warm it'll get just yet.
Did you have to, really tweak your routine because of the move? Because you were in Massachusetts, and where are you now? You're in
Kentucky.
Kentucky, right? Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, what was it like? Well, what was it like moving all the frogs? That's another question.
Oh, it was awful. I hate it. I would never do that again. I would never do it again. It was the worst time ever. Because I pulled all the frogs out just so they weren't jumping around in the tanks, getting hurt, because we weren't really sure how it was going to work out in the moving van. So I pulled out all the frogs first. And it took a lot longer than I expected because I planned all of it the day before the move. And it ended up going until like 3 a.m. at night. That's when we finally got finished. First, I had to catch the frogs, pack them, take off all the lights, tape up the tanks, cover the tanks, break down the racks, break down the misting system, move all the tanks in the moving van. And then we were so tired, what we did was put a heater running in the moving van, took a short nap, woke up the next day. I put all the frogs with me in the car. My partner drove the moving van with one dog. I took a dog, and we just kind of just drove 16 hours with breaks for the dogs to potty. And then we didn't even get to the house when we came. We just crashed at my partner's mom's house, checked on the frogs there, and it's like the second day that they were in styrofoam containers. And then eventually the day after that is when we were able to put everything back up. And then by the third night, the frogs all finally went back in their tanks. Surprisingly, I didn't lose a thing. Well, not frogs. I lost plants, just not frogs.
Really? What do you think was the worst for the plants? Just the change in environment and like the stress of the move?
Oh, not even. It was more forgetting about them. Lack of care. I had a grow tent full of bromeliads. and it didn't come with us during the move. So I had to get another one and set that up, and it kind of just fell behind in the list of projects that we had to do when we moved in. And so all my bromeliads were in bins for way too long. So a few of them melted.
And when you got to the new house, like, did the two of you walk around and you were like, all right, this is going to be my frog room? And like, you just, like, right now it's in the basement, right? Like, did the two of you have to kind of like figure out in advance where you wanted to put it? Okay.
The frog room was scoped out before the house was even settled on. It's like, I'll just take that basement, and then we measured it out, and then I kind of have some 3D experience. So I just kind of drew the racks that I have now and kind of spaced them out, and I just wanted to shove everything the way it was in the old house. That way I could just set them back up and not have to worry about moving stuff around for it to look good. And then I eventually got to the second phase to where, like, okay, now I'm comfortable. I can now move stuff to where I want it. And now I'm up to the point to where I'm finally hooking the Mist King system back up. And I'll be glad when I finally do.
What was the worst part of the move? Like, if you were to just pick one moment or one issue, what was the hardest part?
Moving the tanks. The glass, they're heavy. They're full of substrate. It was a two-man job, and it was just, there was a lot of them. There's like 18. It was just like playing Tetris in the moving van, trying to fit them all in.
And the tanks, I'm assuming, they were in there with furniture too, right? How did you?
No, so all we did was move the hobby first. So it was just in the moving van, all that was in the moving van was a bunch of tanks.
That's great.
And then in the car I was in were a bunch of frogs.
So what did you do? You made a second trip for furniture, or you just?
We got a pod. We loaded everything in a pod. Okay. And then they took that. But we did end up having to do another trip to get the remaining stuff in a U-Haul. So it was a two-trip. Two-trip move.
Oh, that's got to be brutal. 16 hours.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
And if you got stuck in traffic or something happened.
Oh, no. But there was a freak rainstorm halfway where it was raining cats and dogs.
I can't imagine having to move. I mean, my collection's kind of, it's not, I don't have 18 tanks going. I think I've got maybe like 13, including everything, including non-frog stuff. But I just got a 4x2 animal plastics enclosure for one of my snakes who just, you know, he's his full size now. So it just seemed like the right time. And I'm like, they don't look big when they're just stacked up on top of each other at eye level. But when it's on the floor and you physically have to move it, you realize how big some of these enclosures are. Like the 36, like I had to move an 18 by 24 by 24, and like, all right, that I could do. But then I'm like, if it gets any bigger than this is not happening. Like I'm
gonna have once to get it gets bigger than 18, they get pretty hard to move. And then I had to drain them too before we moved them.
And your tanks are drilled?
No, so none of them are. Well, except for the Adelopus tank. But I had to use the shop vac to drain them, and then I had to empty out the shop vac a couple times to fully drain them all. It was a lot of work. It was a long, long weekend.
How long did it take for the frogs to settle in? Did they kind of just go act like nothing had happened, or did you have to wait a little time for them to kind of back to what they were doing?
They just kind of went back to what they were doing.
It's amazing.
I was surprised.
I think that just after years and years of captive breeding and multiple generations, we've selected frogs that just do better in human care than their wild counterparts. Because I remember how, like, it used to be that when you bought frogs at a reptile store, a Petco, there was no live guarantee at all. because that's how fragile they were. So you could buy something, it could die in the parking lot and on your way home, and then you still wouldn't get a live guarantee. But nowadays, things just seem to be doing so well that it's interesting that they could just kind of completely like act like nothing ever happened after sitting in a cup for like 24 hours
shocked.
Straight. Yeah. Well, it's a good thing, though. It just shows you how well that, you know, how well captive animals do in captivity versus wild caught.
Yeah. I fattened them up and then I packed them as if I was shipping them. And put them in styrofoam ice chests, and they all did good.
At what point did you start selling orange Blackfoot Terribilis? Like, what got you into saying, like, all right, I'm going to start selling off some of my tadpoles?
I don't know. I like, the fish keeper in me wants to raise them and watch them grow, just because I could have them in an aquarium. I kind of miss, like, having a bunch of aquariums, so, like, that part of it I enjoy. And so once they started having tadpoles and like people were reaching out, I figured, hey, if I have homes for them to go to, I'll raise them. And I did. And that's what got me into raising them or starting to, raise them.
So I have a guest coming up, Zach. I think his name's Porritt. He's the one with the big greenhouse out in Utah. And he mentioned to me, I think he got some of his frogs from you, right?
Uh-huh. He has five of my Blackfoots.
How did you guys connect?
I think it's just through Instagram. Just by having similar content. And then just, I stumbled upon him. And I thought it was the coolest thing ever. And I asked him what he would add in there. And he said Blackfoot or Terribilis. And I'm like, that's the perfect choice. That's exactly what I would have done. And then from there, he ended up getting them from me.
Yeah, his are beasts. He puts up videos. I found him through you, and like some of like the sub adults and the adults he have now, like they're beasts. They're monsters, and I'm really anxious to ask
it'll
him.
Even get
about,
better once they start calling.
Yeah. That call that notorious Terribilis call. That's why I can't record in my basement because when they sound off, it's so loud.
Now, how many do you have?
I have a trio that's about, I think they're 3 years old now. I got an unsexed trio from Julio at American Frog Day 2021. And they morphed out. Well, they were already morphed out, that's stupid. But they matured into two males and a female. And the female's a huge monster. And they gave me a few clutches. The first one was kind of a dud, and then I got more and more productive, and I raised up a group of nine that I still have. Actually, I have them in a 40 breeder tank, and I can't part with them, which is weird. I can't. I mean, there really isn't like. I mean, now that they're in the hobby, I mean, I think they came in as a Tesoros export, like. Maybe 5 years ago or something like that. And when they first came in, there was they weren't like crazy expensive, but they were anticipated. And now they don't like, you know what I mean? It's not like a niche animal that there's like a huge waiting list for. I mean, you could pretty much get them, they're really readily available.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's not like people are knocking down my door to get them. And I don't know. I feel weird. Like I don't want to part with them. I've got this. Like
no, it's hard letting go.
Yeah. And one of them's a little runt.
I do end up keeping.
A little runt. I'm like, I can't give this away. It's like if I give this away and someone breeds this one, that's not going to be a good idea. And then I don't know. I'm like I overthink stuff. I guess this is just like one of those examples.
No, I end up I've kept my froglets for way too long. I do end up keeping most of them.
Plus, if I was going to sell them, or honestly, I mean, I actually thought about just gifting a few of them to some people, but I want to make sure that they were well enough established that whoever gets them wouldn't have a bad experience. I don't know. I freak out with stuff like that. Like people who breed and sell for a living, they're so good at it. I'm like, man, like you guys have so much like patience. Like it would just drive me nuts. Like I'd be worried about it constantly. Do you ship?
I have, yes. I really don't ship that much. It's more just like a handful of froglets that I raise just so I can watch them grow. But I might start raising more. I've been getting more and more people asking for frogs, so hopefully I can find homes for them all. If not, I end up keeping them.
Yeah, that's the other thing to consider is having unwanted frogs. And even like, let's just forget terribilis for a second, but even some of the large obligates, I've been hearing people are having a difficult time finding people who are interested in paying for them. I mean, frogs that went for like, you know, $1,500 a frog now for like $400 or $500, and people still can't get rid of them.
Mm-hmm. And then I find that even more tougher because you can't really keep them together. With terribilis, you can keep them all together. But with the Ufaga, they'll throw deathmatch.
Yeah, deathmatch. Yeah, terribilis makes such a nice group frog. But the obligates, you said you have Pamelia now, right? Which locales of Pamelia do you have again?
I have two. I have the Colens and the Spotted Eldorado.
And how are you doing with them? Are you looking to breed them or are you just enjoying keeping them?
Yeah, I have froglets for my Colens and my Spotteds are still trying to figure it out. They've been laying clutches, but the clutches have been going bad. But my Colens have been like actively producing clutches every 2 months.
Well, that's not bad.
No, they throw some cool babies, like the little gold and green. There's not many gold and green frogs out there.
Yeah, I have this book. I think it's the Complete Ufaga Pamelia. It was originally in German. I have the English copy of it. And it's the books, I think the book's from, it's earlier than 2015. I think it's an older book. But every known locale of Pamelia is in that book, and it's a really cool reference.
That's a hard book to find these days.
I know. I had a hard time finding it myself.
I've been debating just buying the German version and just looking at the photos.
Yeah, it's worth it. I mean, to be honest, it's pretty much everything in that book can applies to all of dart frog husbandry now. It's not like there's anything that groundbreaking in there. It's all stuff that everyone's been doing for a long time anyway. I mean, the Euro slider tanks are in there, and I mean, it's a great care guide. So, I mean, even if you get it in German, I don't know, this Google Translator or something, you can figure it out. But yeah, the pictures itself are really what the book is best known for.
The Translate app has gone a long way.
Is that even real? Can you do that? Can you just like point the phone at a text and it'll just translate it to you?
Yeah, you could do that now.
God, man, I gotta get with the times.
It's crazy how far it's come.
Yeah. So, moving forward, is there any specific species that you have your eye on or something that you want to work with? Like, let's just say for argument's sake that money was no object and anything and everything was available. Well, let's say captive bred, well established. Like, if you could pick a dream frog to work with, what would it be and why?
I still don't have a large O, so it'd be one of them. I want to have a collection of calls. I think that's how I built my frog room. They each had to sound different from the other. And I don't have a large O that quacks. So that would be one of them, a histo or a sylvatica.
You have your eye on the koi that are coming in?
Not really, no. I'm more of the red and orange, yellow ones. I like those more. I feel like koi, everybody's going to jump on kois. And then I just enjoy the kois through people's photos and all. And then I could just get the one I really want to get, which would be the yellowfoots. I like the yellowfoots.
Any non-dart frog species, like tree frogs or terrestrial frogs or anything like that?
I do want Craspidopus. One of the Craspidopus. Either a Sylvia or a Calcalifer. Eventually, after my time with the Red Eye, how that goes, then I'll be getting the Crespidopus after the Red Eye.
Yeah, I kind of lost interest in tree frogs just because I'd never see them.
Oh, they're cool, yeah. Especially at night.
Well, I mean, I'm in bed at like 9 o'clock, so.
I like to wake up in the middle of the night and just go check up on him and then feed him. Because that's when he's most active, and it's like if he's the most responsive, like in the middle of the night. And I usually tend to stay up late, so right after I go to bed, I'll just go down there and feed him some crickets. It's like, I like watching them hunt and eat. They're pretty cool.
Yeah, the nocturnal behaviors are interesting. Like the mossy frogs I have, they're active at night, and I'll hear them calling, and you know, I'll just go down there with a flashlight after dark and like just like kind of spotlight them, because everything down there is on a timer and it goes off at like 8:30. So in the wintertime, it's dark down there. I'm not in bed that early, but it's cool. You kind of spotlight them and you can see them doing this, you know, these behaviors and the activities that just are like non-existent during the day. Even like my daughter has a crested gecko, and it was kind of staying like on loan to us in our bedroom. So my wife and I'd be laying in bed at night, and I just hear this thing like flying all over the cage and just like making this huge ruckus. And like during the day when the lights are on, it's like non-existent. It's just like a potato that just sits in the corner and does nothing. And then at night, yeah, it comes alive and it's doing all sorts of crazy gymnastics, which is cool though. I mean, it's fun. I just wasn't expecting it.
We used to keep our Lychianus gecko in the living room. And we'd stay up watching TV. So whenever the lights went off is when he would wake up. And then this is a big ass gecko. And he would just be running around, jumping and flopping everywhere. But during the day, he just is right out in the open like a statue.
Now, that's an interesting dynamic here, because everything you've got frog-wise is by and large very brightly colored, real visible. The lychees, like you just said, are like perfect camouflage. What drew you to the lychees?
It's my partner's pet.
Oh, okay.
He really wanted it. He wanted a big gecko.
Did the two of you have like different interests? Like one is interested in frogs and like not anything else? Like it's interesting how like certain people who have, you know, partners, whatever it is, partner, spouse, whatever, like one person will focus entirely on one species and the other person like could totally care less and is focused on another species.
Yeah, I take care of it all, but the geckos are his interest, although he does love the Atalopus, and then the frogs are more my passion.
I gotcha. Yeah, I know of some people who are like, you know, married, boyfriend, or whatever, and like one person is totally into one species of snake and the other person is totally into frogs, and it's like It, like the two worlds do not like ever cross paths, which I thought is funny, because it's like if you're into animals, I feel like, you know, it's kind of like one, what do they call it, like a Venn diagram, you know, where there's the two circles and they intersect.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I mean, it shouldn't even be a Venn diagram, it should just be one big circle, but I don't know, what do I know?
They're pretty cool to have. I do enjoy having them, especially the gargoyle geckos, like their pattern and their head shape, and they're a bit more crazier compared to crested geckos and lychee geckos.
Yeah, I've never had one.
They enjoy eating insects a lot more, so they're very active and hunt, and they just seem crazy when they go after a cricket. I haven't really shown them yet because I haven't gotten to their builds yet.
Oh, how are you planning on doing that type of build?
I might just do it similar to the lychee build. Cork. The cork branches, cork background, and cork rounds. They seem to really enjoy cork.
How big do the lychees get? I mean, I've seen some up close, but I mean, how, like...
Oh, they get pretty good. He's about, I would say, 13 to 14 inches long now, around 200 grams.
Oh, he's a monster.
Yeah, he's a big dude.
Wow. This is huge. How big is this enclosure?
It is 2436.
Oh, okay.
Which in the beginning I thought would be too small, because for some reason a lot of people recommend 1824s. But once they get big, it just seems cramped. So he might be getting an upgrade eventually, because they don't really stop growing until they're like three.
It's just, yeah, I mean, it's just, seeing my crested gecko and imagine something like quadruple that size.
And then their poops are even bigger.
Yeah, I didn't want to say that. That was going to be my next <problem. laughs> It's like people, I guess, like, look at keeping frogs as overly complicated, but like, you're not wiping crap off of glass constantly like we are with geckos or any other arboreal species, or really, I mean, like any species. I mean, with the substrate and everything going and the plants, other than changing leaf litter, maybe like twice a year, I'll scrape the top layer off and refresh it. I mean, I'm never cleaning up anything. It all just gets taken care of inside the tank. But like the crested gecko, oh man, like she just like destroys the walls sometimes with her projectiles.
Yeah. That's why I stick with fish and frogs. I don't have to clean up their poops.
Yeah. Now, do you monitor the water parameters in the paludarium for the Atelopus? Like, do you test the pH and like any of that stuff?
I did in the beginning, but now I usually don't. Like, I do water changes about once every 2 weeks, or once every 1 to 2 weeks. I'll switch that out and I'll just use RO and I'll remineralize that water and add it back in, but I don't really test it.
How does the remineralization work? Because I know, like, I use just straight RO just for misting purposes, but like people like you who are seriously into aquariums and whatnot that need to do that, how, like, what's that process like? Like, how do you go from RO to remineralizing water?
It was an episode of yours that got me to start doing it. Because before that, I would just use tap. And then I think it was the one lady that worked at the ABG was what finally made me take the dip into the RO, or remineralizing the RO. And I just used a tablespoon for 5 gallons. And it seems to do the trick. It adds the parameters back to where I want it and has not caused any problems. And it's clean. It's safer than my tap water, because the tap water is a bit on the hard side.
Do you have a preference for, like, when you do aquariums and you do water changes, do you use any tap water, or do you use all remineralized RO water?
If I could, I would. But for the aquariums, they just get tap. They get dechlorinated tap.
Gotcha. Which dechlorinator do you like to use?
Seachem Prime. It's been my go-to for years.
So before we wrap up, I want to ask you about another photo on your Instagram, which I think is absolutely awesome. And I think you know which one I'm talking about. It's the jumping spider.
Oh, yeah.
Just rolling in what looks like a matchbox car.
Ford Mustang.
Yeah. What's your take on the jumping spiders now? I mean, obviously you have this one. Like, I mean, have you ever thought of doing a build for a jumping spider?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have one. I love them. They're my favorite. I love inverts. They just fascinate me. So mantises, jumping spiders, the snails, the shrimp. They're just fascinating to me. And I do have, he's in, a, or she's in a, an 8812 build with cork. And she's the second one that I've had in there.
Cool. And that's the... I think it's Philippinus is the genus.
Uh-huh. Regus.
Yeah, yeah. I had one. I had a wild caught one that I found somewhere in my house. I was like, all right, let me just keep this little guy for a while. And they don't live very long, too, which kind of stinks. They only live like a couple of months to like a year, maybe 2 years at the most.
The females usually extend, like, push a year or two, depending on when you get it.
Now, what went into taking that photo? That's my next question.
Oh, I was just I don't know. It was just kind of random. I saw the car. It was a present. And I was like, you know what would be cool? I put the spider in there and made it look like it was driving. Couldn't really do that. And I didn't want to stress out the spider too much. So I just kind of let it walk around and took pictures as it did.
Yeah, they're real photos.
That was a fun one.
Yeah, it's a cool photo. Some of the macro shots of them are really impressive when you see the eyes and like the Chilicera and it's and they're so small too, they're tiny. Mm-hmm. And you don't really appreciate it until you actually see one up close and you realize it's like the size of a pencil eraser. They're so small.
Mm-hmm. And they're harmless.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Sharif,
they're fun.
Before we break, I mean, where do you see yourself over the next couple of years with the hobby and the builds? What's your goal to be 5 years from now? You want to have more tanks? Do you want to do bigger builds? Or like in a perfect world, where would you like to see yourself go in the hobby?
I would ideally like more bigger builds. I've slowly been upgrading them one at a time ever since I started. And I just want to continue that. I do think bigger builds are the way to go, and you do see more behaviors from the frogs, and I enjoy just watching them interact with it all. Walk around, you get to see them walk, and all the behaviors that you don't really see in a smaller tank. So upgrading would be my future plan.
What about the frog room itself? Like you guys are in Kentucky for the long haul.
Yeah. And then I'm set on frogs too. I don't think I'll be, well, maybe one or two more, but I don't think I'll be adding any more anytime soon.
Yeah, long term. It's like you reach a certain point where you get settled.
Yeah, my goal was 10. I'm kind of pushing it now, but it's still manageable. It's not too crazy.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine having more than I have now. It's just like, I mean, the older I've gotten, the more settled I've got. I'm like, you know what? I want to just enjoy what I have rather than trying to stress on getting more animals. Like I had a couple of animals that passed away recently, like one from old age and one.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's just, my pixie frog passed away. She had I hate to oversimplify something like a bad shed, but she ended up, she shed and she had some skin that sloughed off, and we treated it pretty aggressively. And unfortunately, it didn't work out. And unfortunately she died, which sucks. I mean, we had her for a while. We had her for like a good six or 7 years. But, after that, I'm like, you know what? Like, I just kind of want to be happy with what I've got and not try to stress about trying to fill a whole room up anymore. And I think that's kind of where the hobby's going for like most people. I feel like that whole like collector's bug is kind of not, doesn't really have that presence in the hobby that it used to.
Yeah. Yeah. See, for me, it's the Fruit Fight cultures. Like, I feel like the more you have, the more stressful it gets. Because if they crash, how would you get that amount again? So I like sticking with less than 10. Right now, I run 7 cultures. And I don't think I would do more than that.
Do you use melanogaster or Heidi Eye? Because the Heidi Eye, I quit using entirely because of the aggravation.
I used to do 6 melanogaster and 1 golden Heidi Eye. But I eventually just phased out the Heidi Eye and just made 7 melanos. I used to use them for tinks. But I just found that you just could feed them more Milanos and they'll do just as well.
Yeah, the Heidi, I got tired of dealing with the boom and bust, and then I felt like I had a bigger mite problem with them. I just couldn't get ahead of it with them, with the mites.
Yeah, I kept getting mold issues that I couldn't figure out with them.
Just with the Heidi?
Yeah, just with the Heidi. Really? No issues with Milanos. It always molded with Heidi.
I think it's just that longer life cycle, that extra couple of days or week or whatever it is. I just feel like it, I don't know, like the melanogaster just seem to go to work on the media really quickly. And maybe that's it. They don't have they don't give it a chance to mold over as quickly as the Heidi idea. I don't know. Maybe I'm just speculating. But So Sharif, before we wrap up, is there anything that you want to, you know, any Instagram or any social media, anything you want to recommend to people so they can check out your tanks?
So far, it's all on Instagram. There is a YouTube, but there's really not much on there. Just one short. And there is a TikTok, but I think there's just maybe 6 videos on there. But other than that, it's mainly all Instagram for me. It's the app that I've enjoyed using the most. It's the app I grew on and met friends on. And it's the app I'll probably just stick with when it comes to posting content.
Cool. All right, everyone. I want to thank Sharif for coming on, talking to us about, you know, different types of builds and whatnot in the Atalopus. And I learned a lot about the cork builds. And, you know, again, whatever you guys are into, you know, always cool to get different perspectives and try different things. And the cork builds has been on my mind for quite some time. And I want to thank Sharif for coming on and talking to us about it.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. And of course, check out, you know, if you haven't already done so, check out Sharif's social media. Some beautiful photos, some beautiful frogs, beautiful builds. And just, you know, all around great stuff. And I'm scrolling through Instagram as I'm going through this. I just like your photos are great. So
I try to mix it up when it comes to frogs, not just have the repeating ones.
Yeah, and that Atalopus photo is famous. So, I mean, if you haven't, you know, if you haven't, go look at Sharif's Instagram page. Look at my dumb comment on the Atalopus with the, you know, the butt cheeks, and I mean that photo alone will make your day. So, all right, everyone.
It's
again,
a good one.
All right, everyone. This has been a fun one. Again, I'm really glad I got a chance to talk to Sharif on the show. We've talked so much time, you know. Messaged a lot off air and whatnot. I'm really glad that you know, we got a chance to come on and talk together. So yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed it. You know, if you're interested in checking out one of these cork builds, of course, check out Sharif's Instagram. Got some great photos on there. And other than that, I hope you guys enjoyed this one, and I'll catch up with you again next time.